This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Oh God, it's an international break, but don't worry, we can get as angry as anyone else about the number of right-backs in the England squad and Harry Maguire's inclusion. They could get relegated this weekend to the Championship, we presume. More importantly, they've signed up to the One Love campaign against discrimination in Qatar. Is it good or just PR? Also, we're joined by Ashley Brown from the Football Supporters Association. He's been on a fact-finding mission to Qatar. And apart from, well, the World Cup probably shouldn't be happening there, he'll have some actual insight into what it's like for anyone who chooses to go. There's Scotland's big and crucial win over Ukraine to mull over, the rest of the Nations League to preview, all that, plus a fun-looking Christmas party at Dundee United, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, John Bruin, welcome.
Hello, Max. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Hello, Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max. Good morning.
Good morning. And Nick Ames, a late replacement for Jordan Jarrett Bryan off the bench. Our colleague Will Unwin saying, did Nick go full Tonya Harding? Is that how you got this gig? Did he have to get changed in the car park, says Michael. Nick says, what's the biggest job you've ever had to do at short notice? We have every faith in you, Nick, this morning.
Yeah, I hope I'm not an Ali Deer and you have to sub the sub after 10 minutes. But I guess the truth will tell.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you can have some real hot takes if you want, and just pick a Premier League team at random and decide to hate them, and then just die on that hill, whatever you'd like to do. Let's start, shall we, with England. We're quite close to a World Cup. They're in a Nations League relegation scrap, playing Italy on Friday, playing Germany on Monday. If England lose, they'll be relegated to League B. I've sunk your battleship of the Nations League for the first time, and they need to beat Italy and Germany to be sure of safety. Does that mean, John, that this game matters?
We still don't know whether the Nations League matters, do we? Now, listen, obviously it matters in terms of more minor teams qualifying because of the roundabout way, the, I suppose, repechage competition you have for qualification for major tournaments. But for those top nations, does it really matter? I'm not sure. And I suppose the gauge that I would use of that is that when I have watched the press conferences with the various England players, and I think there's one with Gareth Southgate to come, nobody seems to have asked them about the Nations League. It just appears to be a series of discussions of football issues such as social media. Jordan Henderson talked about events in Paris last May, June. I'm not sure that the nation is fully focused on the Nations League, when perhaps they should be, because I keep looking at this World Cup ticker and seeing that it's only 60 days away or something like that. But, I mean, even the coverage of whether Jude Bellingham should play, who is, there's always a bright star going into a tournament, and Jude Bellingham is that guy this time. The discussion isn't about whether he should play 6-8 or, off the flanks or whatever. It's whether he'll go to Liverpool or Manchester United. I think we've lost focus on the Nations League.
Have you got focus, Lars? I mean, you're focused on all football all the time. So if anyone is focused, you are focused.
I like the Nations League. I'll confess, England's fate in the Nations League is not something that's very present in my mind at all times. I have to admit, though, you can make funny jokes about how the good thing about the Nations League is if you're paired against nations that are kind of at your level, and if you're not good enough to be in the tier you are, then you get relegated, which is what appears to have happened. But I think for smaller countries across Europe, such as the one I was born in, the Nations ring does matter, because first of all, it is an extra playoff spot for if you win your group for the next tournament, but it's also coefficient points, which again, if you've grown up supporting England, you've probably never been in a position where you really care about seeding points and coefficients and things. But I suspect some of our listeners from the other from the other nations around this island and some of the other places around Europe will know that for smaller nations, the coefficient and what pot you're in for the draw is incredibly big in terms of your chances of qualifying. So in that regard, these games actually matters an awful lot, even if they don't always feel like it when they happen. So I think in terms of what the Nations League delivers, this will be a party political broadcast on behalf of the Nations League party. For the weaker nations, right down the bottom, it gives them competitive games against nations that are roughly their level, which must be useful for them. For the sort of medium-sized nations, like my own, it gives you an extra route into a tournament and coefficient points that can matter a lot. And for the bigger nations, it gives you theoretically competitive games against other bigger nations, which is what they're always crying out for. So it does seem to theoretically tick a lot of boxes. And then when it comes around, we're all a little bit, meh. So I can see that one. It's a strange one.
Yeah, I mean, actually, a weekend where we play Italy and Germany is quite exciting. But you're right, it needs 200 years of history to become a important thing, and that seems quite a long way away. And a lot of it, Nick, is the preparation for the World Cup, right? And the squad that Gareth Southgate has picked. It was last week, but we didn't really touch on it until today. I guess the headlines are the fact that Luke Shaw and Harry Maguire are picked, even though they're not playing for Manchester United, and the inclusion of Eric Dyer, who is playing well for Spurs, and Ivan Toney, who is playing well for Brentford.
Yeah, and that's the thing for England, isn't it? These two games plus the four games that we had in June are basically your World Cup warm-ups. And because of the timing of a World Cup when it is, it's inevitable that we're going to be watching these games through that prism. Now, I think that for Gareth Southgate, playing Italy away, who haven't qualified and will be quite up for it, you would think, and then Germany at home, when there's a bit of notional jeopardy on getting relegated, whether we care about that or not, given that the punishment might be a slightly harder route to the next Euros, it's very, very opportune, I think, to have two games like that to sharpen you up before a major tournament. He'll be quite delighted by that. And there are a lot of questions to answer, as you say. Quite a lot of players not been at the top of their game, if they've been playing much at all, for their clubs. I mean, what happens with players like Maguire and Shaw will be very interesting. I think Calvin Phillips has pulled out, hasn't he? And been replaced by Jordan Henderson, which presumably nudges Mr. Bellingham a bit closer to things, should Southgate want to go down that route. And it does feel like there's a lot of questions to answer, which maybe we weren't asking at the start of June. And obviously those games went quite disastrously from an England point of view. Nothing really fired going forward. Defence was a bit porous, especially against Hungary at home, of course. And if I go back to the 0-0 draw with Italy at Molineux, which I really don't want to do because it was one of the worst games I've ever covered.
Totally blanked it from my memory. I literally, absolutely blanked it.
Do you know what? It was 3 months ago. I was covering it for us with Dave Heitner and Barney Renee, and I had to go back just before this pod and read all of our pieces to remember anything about it. except for the fact that they were booed off at the end by 2,000 school children. All that I'd remembered actually was pre-match. Chris Powell was sort of being a one-man entertainment hype man for the kids on the pitch. And that was by far the most lovely, endearing memory of it. Anyway, I digress. It was shocking. I suspect we'll see two stronger teams this time out, especially from Italy. And I do think England need to show something. I think it would help in terms of morale of those who care about such things going into the tournament. I think Southgate needs a good idea of what his alternatives are as well. It'd be very interesting to see if and when Ivan Toney gets some minutes, I think, given that his international debut will presumably come pretty much in at the deep end against a good opponent, whether it's Italy or Germany. Can he be your kind of almost like-for-like analogue for Harry Kane that maybe Tammy Abraham isn't? He's a different sort of player, Tammy, isn't he? He'll kind of stretch you along the lines down the channels, whereas Toney maybe is a bit better at holding onto the ball, bringing other people in, and also has got that set-piece ability. So I think issues like that will be interesting to discover, whether Dyer can come straight back in and show that he can start a tournament after a year and a half out in the cold, also fascinating. So look, in terms of the minutiae for England, there's a lot to get into. And there's not a very long time to sort it out. And I guess for Southgate, there's the eternal juggling act of tweaking and finessing and finalising. And then the fact that people don't expect England to get thrashed, which obviously happened against Hungary. And then he got a hell of a lot of reaction to it. So it's going to be an interesting few days.
Well, I mean, and I suppose the question then, John, is what are those things that England have to prove? And will they? And what are the biggest questions for him? It's interesting to see if Dyer does come in, if Stones and what you think Stones, Walker, Maguire is the three that are sort of set vaguely in stone. Does Bellingham have to start? Lots of people will yell, Bellingham has to start, and we have to build the team around him for a decade. And then obviously we judge Ivan Toney completely on 25 minutes in one of these games on whether he can be an international footballer or not.
Well, and Ivan Toney, I was with Nick on Sunday at Brentford Arsenal, in which he didn't get a kick, did he? And so therefore, we've got to rule him out from being any use at all, ever, such is the way of these things. No, I think he's a very good player and was overdue a call-up, I would say. Yeah, I'm just looking through the squad, and I suppose the issue is, isn't it, that at this time of the season, a lot of players won't have hit their straps, and there are those players who, I mean, obviously Maguire and Shaw are the two. I mean, they can't get a game for the club, and yet they're called up. And then you've got players like Tomori, AC Milan. You know, is he good enough to step in and replace someone like Harry Maguire? I have my doubts about that. And you've got fringe players like James Ward-Prowse. You know, excellent Premier League player. Is he good enough to be in the England squad? And then you have, and actually thinking about, you know, it's a game against Italy, and you cast your mind back to Euro 2020, obviously in 2021. Someone like Mason Mount. Now, Mason Mount in the summer of 2021 looked a Rolls Royce of a player. I know you, what's the car we have to refer to these days?
A Tesla. And actually, if we're honest, I think it's only centre backs that can be.
Oh, okay. Really? Well, anyway. So what would he be then? Like some sort of.
I think you just say he's dynamite, or he's a guaranteed star, or he's a player's player, isn't he, Mason Mount?
Yeah, he's a player's player, but I'm not sure the players think that player is.
Like he's more of a hybrid car, you know, not very loud, very efficient, very useful.
True. Yeah, but I think the engine is sputtering a bit. Let's put it that way. I've not really been that impressed by Mount for a while. Now Chelsea fans could probably set me straight on that, but I do think he's been. One of the players that suffered a little bit as Chelsea have slipped away a bit. You've also got the Trent Alexander-Arnold question, you know, which is a perpetual question. I'll say it now. I don't think Southgate is going to take him to the World Cup. This will cause, a big fuss. But on form, you wouldn't take him to the World Cup, just as you wouldn't take someone like Luke Shaw and Harry Maguire. But these are the type of questions Gareth Southgate's got to answer, and as Nick says, you've got to do it without getting stuffed in a game by Italy, who are going to be really motivated because they've got something to prove themselves. Hey, maybe the Nations League is more interesting than I thought when you asked me that first question.
England have joined the One Love campaign. A statement from the FA said they'll join forces with the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, France, Germany, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland and Wales in a campaign against discrimination, originally initiated by the Dutch. It'll use the power of football to promote inclusion, send a message against discrimination of any kind as the eyes of the world fall on the global game. The message will be symbolised by respective men's national team captains wearing the distinctive One Love armband. Harry Kane said, I'm honoured to join my fellow national team captains in supporting the important One Love campaign. As captains, we may all be competing against each other on the pitch, but we stand together against all forms of discrimination. Maybe I'm naive to think it's good that these teams have got together, they're talking about something and they're doing something. The reaction hasn't been entirely positive. Adam Crafton, writing the armband, says, One Love, too polite to say the words gay rights, I presume. Recognise us if you want to stand up for us. Adam's, of course, gay. Beth Fisher, panellist here, said it's grotesque. Jim, friend of the pod, also from the LGBTQ+ community, said, look, while there's many more important questions about Qatar, am I the only one that's heartened by England taking part in the One Love campaign? I don't know. I mean, I it doesn't feel like this is going to solve anything, but it is possibly better than doing nothing, Nick. Or is it? I don't know.
Well, the best that can be said for it is that it's keeping a conversation going, and we're all having this conversation now, but I do question whether that conversation is really going to be extending that far beyond all of our Twitter echo chambers about the extent of what they've done. I just think it isn't enough. You've got to be bold and brave enough to call these things out for what they are. Say what you're supporting. Say what the discrimination that you are fighting against is. Show it. And I think it's all just a bit mealy-mouthed for me. The more I think about it, actually, it's one thing having a conversation, but we've been having these conversations about how football should act and how football should respond for so long, and this simply prolongs them. It doesn't. It just kicks things into the long grass. So I'm fairly a little bit negative and sceptical about what they've landed on, to be honest. And I think they could have come down with something much more powerful and much less sort of shrouded in corporate speak as well.
Yeah, we've had lots of tweets about saying, you know, what's the point of continuing these conversations if we don't ever get anywhere? I guess, you know, a podcast is a platform where you have conversations. It's quite difficult to stop them. We've got lots of plans pre-Qatar for what we're going to do on all of these subjects, on all areas of the discrimination. And we're talking to some very interesting people, and we will bring those to you before the World Cup. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with a football match that actually happened. Scotland beating Ukraine 3-0 last night.
It starts the same way.
Can I tell you a secret?
It would start off with a random girl and just say, hey hun, I'm going to tell you some secret now. Please don't mention it to anybody.
But it quickly escalates.
It just spread like a wildfire.
I still sleep with clubs next to my bed.
I didn't know how far this was going to go.
People seldom show their true selves online. But one man, he's taken it much further.
I was terrified.
Who is the cyberstalker behind these messages?
He actually said to me, good luck proving it's me.
And why is he sending them?
Because he became more and more isolated. He just went within himself even further.
Do you punish someone for acting out whatever is going on in their mind that we don't understand?
And if I could just turn back the clock.
From The Guardian, I'm Shireen Khaled, and this is Can I Tell You a Secret? A story about obsession, fear, and the lives we lead online. Search for Can I Tell You a Secret wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now. All episodes will be available on Friday, the 23rd of September.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Scotland 3, Ukraine 0. That puts Scotland top of League B Group 1. 24 shots against Ukraine's 3. If they win the group and then they don't qualify for Euro 2024, they'll get a second shot via the playoffs. That is why this is important. John, you watched the match. And actually, Scotland were very impressive in this game, weren't they?
Yeah, they were excellent. They were excellent. And again, belying my lack of interest in the Nations League, this game had a lot of needle, you know.
You don't know yourself, John.
No,
do you?
That's
what we learned from this.
You're not the first person to say that. But I obviously Scotland met Ukraine over the summer, and maybe there was a bit of residual feeling there, but there was a lot of challenges flying in. We should actually sound a note of, well, if not caution. Actually, very sad to see Nathan Patson, who's been such a good player for Scotland over the last couple of years, making a bit of a name for himself at Everton, went off with what looked an injury. Wait, news on that. But Scotland picked themselves up from that blow and played really, really well. But there was a point when it did look as if they weren't going to score, despite absolutely dominating. Now, I've seen that story before from Scotland, and we weren't quite in Chris Iwolumo territory, but it just wasn't happening. John McGinn scored a very Scottish-style goal. And the reason I say Scottish-style goal, I think we've discussed on this pod before, Kenny Dalglish's big bum. Now, Kenny was in the stands with his good lady wife. And now, I think in the Premier League, this goal might have been disallowed because John McGinn used his sizeable, though no doubt firm, rump to shove the defender out of the way, be first to the ball and finished very well in a fashion actually we haven't seen too much for Aston Villa this season. And that started it, and then Lyndon Dykes, I think scored his first goal in a year, came on very impressed with his tattoos, I must say, really you know, snaking up the neck to the point of, you know, is he going to go for the face? Scotland were excellent. Any game is made better by Ali McCoist's enthusiasm bubbling, and he loved it. And yeah, it was a great performance. Scotland, it must be strange being a Scotland fan at the moment because they have been quite good over the last few years, haven't they? Missed out on the World Cup. That was pretty, you know, they weren't good enough to get there. I still think Steve Clarke's doing a good job with them. Again, there's someone that has a lot more interest and belief in the Nations League than I do. So, well done, Scotland.
Yeah, and I guess actually, Lars, if they did get promoted to League A, if they win this group, they would. That would actually be great for them. That sounded really patronising.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Yes, it did.
God, sorry, Scottish people. Sorry, Barca Jim.
But it would be good, and I haven't checked the implications for the coefficient, but I mean, if it pops them up into pot two in the draw for the next qualifying campaign, that's a big deal. You know, these are the things that sound really boring, but in terms of actually making it to the tournament, to a tournament, it makes a really big difference. And I think with Scotland, watching this team, I speak as someone who's from a nation that's been quite rubbish for a while. Like, we've got some really tasty players now, obviously, but there's been a couple of fallow decades for us. And the thing I sort of increasingly started to think is that if with the national team, you've got the players you've got, right? It's not like a club team where you can be annoyed at the club for not buying better players. For the national team, you have the people you have. So you can kind of reconcile yourself with not being the best team in the world. But what you do want to see are players who run around a lot and fight and kick people and just sort of, you know, go into battle for you. And I think watching this game, I mean, whatever else you say about Scotland, there was a lot of desire on display here, and I thought they, you know, outfought Ukraine to a large extent, and they got players who are a little bit decent, so they can be a threat.
Obviously, Nick, Ukraine didn't turn up for this game like they did in that game against Scotland before, which was so sort of wrought with emotion, that last game that set up the playoff with Wales. Pete says, can we get an update on Nick's excellent Ukraine piece? Are games generally going ahead okay? I don't know if you've kept in touch with how the Ukrainian league is going.
Thanks for the question, Pete. I think the fact that you might not have heard much about it in the last month or so is good news, because it tells you that nothing serious has happened beyond what's on the pitch. There've been no, I mean, the first air raid interruption came, I think, air raid siren interruption came, I think, the day after I left a month or so ago in a game in the West, and the game was suspended for a while, but then carried on, and that's been much the case since. I think they're now four games in. The team at the top are a fairly small but well-run club outside Kyiv called Kolos Kovalivka, and everything is pretty much going to plan. And as the protocols that I discussed at some length from Kyiv a few weeks ago are still going on. So, no, it's been a resounding success so far. And obviously it's something that they keep reviewing on a day-to-day basis, because that's the only way that anyone can review things at this moment. So yeah, we keep our fingers crossed. As for the national team yesterday, yeah, it wasn't anything like the intensity that we saw in that game at Hampden in June, when they absolutely outplayed Scotland. I think they missed Zinchenko yesterday, actually, who wasn't fit to play. He's got a thigh injury, I can't remember. But in that game in June, he put, I mean, for me watching in person, one of the great individual performances. He was just absolutely everywhere, just an absolute man possessed. So they missed him, but were quite deservedly beaten, as John has outlined last night.
Wales go to Belgium. Lots of Welsh fans over there, but they're bottom of their group. No wins. They don't really care because they've got a World Cup to play in, their first World Cup for decades. That group could end up with Netherlands, Belgium in the final game. Could be kind of a shootout for who gets to the finals of the Nations League. Yes, John?
Yeah, looking at the Belgium squad the other day, and I noticed that Roberto Martinez, still the manager, and I was looking at their squad, and it feels like a sort of Premier League All-Stars of about 5 years ago.
Is it the golden generation or now what, the brass generation?
Yeah, and you know, this just shows you that, you know, if you're a small country, you enjoy it while you can, because it might not last. And, you know, they've still got, you know, well, Eden Hazard is still the captain, still just 31, still at Real Madrid, in case you were wondering. The player that really stuck out to me, apart from Dedrick Boyata, who again, still just 31, was Jason Denayer, who doesn't have a club. I saw a classic Roberto Martinez described his situation as suboptimal, which I thought was
very funny.
But we did kind of speculate, didn't we, that Gareth Bale might do that. He might just play for Wales. I mean, he's not playing a huge amount, but he is enjoying his club football in Los Angeles.
But I suspect Jason Denayer would like a club, but can't get one for some reason. He's only 27. Perhaps he's had injuries, but, you know, I mean, again, yeah, actually, some of these players are younger than you thought, I think. But they really are.
Yeah. Dedrick Boyata can't be under 50. I'm not having it. I just don't believe it. Wales correspondent Ben Fisher joins us on Monday. On his day off, he says, I mean, there's no days off in this job. He has promised red-hot Wales chats. We'll be the judge of that, Ben. Northern Ireland play Kosovo on Saturday. They'll be safe if they bet a Cyprus's result in the final two games. Failed to do that, they could end up in the playoffs, the relegation playoffs, for a place in the bottom tier with teams like San Marino. Just a note before we end part two, David Conn has got an exclusive in The Guardian about the Champions League final, and apparently that the UEFA statement blaming Liverpool supporters for causing a delay was pre-prepared a considerable time before the day of the match. The big screen at the Stade de France announced that a delay to the scheduled 9 p.m. kickoff of the final was due to the late arrival of fans, which it wasn't. And obviously, we've spoken about it a lot. There is a Today in Focus, which is out today on their pod feed. But if you don't download that, we're going to stick it on our feed tomorrow, and you can have a listen to that episode because it is really important. Yes, John?
I was just going to say there's a very good interactive guide to what happened in Paris as well on the website as well. Well worth a look.
Okay.
Very good.
Go and have a look at that.
Yeah.
Because it's an important story, and another big and important, if yet depressing, story from David Conn. That'll do for part two. In part three, Ashley Brown from the FSA joins us. He's been to Qatar to find out what the fan experience might be like. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. James says, have they started building hotels for the people going to Qatar yet? Or will people be sleeping in tents on the streets? Have they built the streets yet, even? Look, we can actually get into a bit of what it's like in Qatar with Ashley Brown from the Football Supporters Association, who we have spoken to many times on this podcast. Thanks so much. You've been to Qatar, Ashley. How was it?
Yeah, I was there with a colleague a couple of weeks ago. It's a lot further progressed than it was in December last year when we last visited. A lot of the hotels are finished. In typical Qatari fashion, I think any building that isn't finished, they're being told to put the outside up first, so at least it looks finished. So it doesn't look like a building site. And although the road works are still ongoing, it was a lot better than last time we were there when the roads were being dug up all over the place.
Were you a guest of a World Cup committee who's getting fan groups to go over there, or were you just going of your own volition? Could you go where you wanted and poke your nose around, or were you very much kind of led by some sort of official?
No, we were there on our own with our own planning. The FSA always tries to do a recce of any country, any city that England's playing in, and we had planned that and arranged some meetings with various people from the Supreme Committee, various hoteliers and bar owners, as well as the British consulate out there. As it happened, the week that we were going, they were hosting the Lusail Cup, which was the sort of opening test event of of the World Cup final stadium. So they did ask us if we'd stay on and provide a report of what we thought about the way that that ground worked. So we did stay an extra day or so at their invitation, and they provided us tickets for that so we could go and check it out.
Okay, let's start. For fans who are thinking to go, I've heard lots of things about accommodation. It not being ready, you've kind of touched on that, but how it's going to cost absolutely buckets to get there, or you're going to be staying somewhere else and staying on a ship or staying in a different country and flying in. What's the vibe that you get now?
So let's start with the ships. I think if you're lucky enough to be on a ship, you've probably got a pretty good setup there. There's two cruise ships. They're trying to get a third. I think all your food, you can get all food and drink packages included on the ships. You'll be able to watch the games on the ships, and you're fairly central. So you're probably made if you're there. Most people probably aren't in hotels. FIFA kept 80% of the hotel rooms for themselves, and a lot of the other hotels with the use the 20% for their existing contracts with like the oil and gas companies, etc. So there's been very few hotels available. Next week, I believe FIFA have to start handing back any of the hotel rooms that they're not using. So we may see some appear, but you know, any hotels that we've seen have been ridiculous pricing. A lot of England and Wales fans will probably book themselves or have booked themselves into the apartments, or the sort of cabins slash tents that are being built out in the desert. We didn't see the cabins. We spoke to people who had seen the cabins. I can't be too enthused about those, to be honest. They're probably not going to be the most interesting places to stay. They couldn't give us any firm commitment on what type of entertainment, food and beverage, etc. will be available, just that there will be. I guess on the positive side, there will be regular free buses running from all those locations to other places into the city where you can go and perhaps find something to do. Apartment-wise, not many of those are central. West Bay is the central area of Doha. Most of those are either to the north or the south. But again, there is free bus services running from those key locations to get people around the city. If I'm honest, it's going to be a little bit different World Cup to most of the normal ones that people would have been to before. You are going to be a bit out on a limb, I think, in some of those accommodation locations. Even if you do bus into the city, there isn't a huge amount to do, to be honest. And of course, there's a lot of people all in one space. This is the first time we've had all the team supporters in what is effectively not a huge city, let alone a country. And that's going to be interesting, where people are going to go, where they're going to find, what they're going to find to do, where they're going to buy a beer. All of those things will be challenges. And we've been pulling together some information that we will provide England and Wales fans in the coming weeks, which will hopefully help them.
Yeah, booze is a part of a World Cup, right? Going out, having dinner, having a drink. It's consuming alcohol is illegal, but there are certain exceptions. What does that tangibly actually mean?
Yeah, so I mean, let's start with a definite no's. So no off sales. You cannot buy off sale alcohol in supermarkets anywhere at all. Residents may be able to buy it if they have a permit, but you won't get one. Don't even think about taking alcohol into the country, buying it duty-free and carrying it through. If you are found to do that, your best effort is it gets confiscated. Your worst is that they stick you on a plane and send you back home again. So don't even try that. So where can you get booze? So the booze is available in the 4- and 5-star hotels dotted around Doha, in their bars and restaurants. But it ain't cheap. Outside of a happy hour, for a pint of something exciting like Heineken or Budweiser, you will be probably talking in the region of £12 or £15.
Oh, I mean, you haven't been selling it. You haven't been selling the cheap. Blimey. 15 quid. Whose round is it? Oh, well, I'm all, wow.
If you're lucky enough to find a happy hour and it's your round, you may get away with something as cheap as £7 for a pint. But actually, you know, getting into those bars is not going to be easy. It's not like going into London and, you know, there's been bars and cafes and restaurants all over the place. You know, the numbers are limited in Doha. So actually finding space, particularly when some of those hotels are already taken up with teams or with other FIFA delegations and therefore not necessarily accessible to the likes of us normal fans, that will cut some of the capacity out. The other places you can get a drink, so the big fan festival at Albeda Park, this is a fan festival with the capacity of 40,000 people, supposedly. That will sell alcohol between 6:30 and either midnight or 1 in the morning. So no good if you've got a daytime game to go there and get a beer beforehand. It'll be dry up until 6:30 in the evening. As that's a FIFA event, it's Budweiser only.
Oh, that's worse than the £15, isn't it?
They wouldn't tell us what the price is going to be. They said that they will make it affordable. We're not quite sure. Affordable to an English fan and affordable to a Qatari are two different things. But hopefully it'll be reasonably priced. The only other fan festival site that will sell alcohol at this point in time is Arcadia, which is, if anyone knows, Glastonbury, the great big giant metal spider that has a DJ booth in it. They've taken that all the way out to Qatar and are doing daily dance house rave events from, bizarrely.
You've got to be joking me.
Well, you wait till you hear the hours of this one, because this is the bizarre thing. This runs from 10 in the morning till 5 the following morning.
What?
And supposedly can sell alcohol throughout that period.
All right, but you have to be at a rave.
And you got to pay a minimum of £75 to get into the rave.
Right. Okay. Can you talk to us about broadcasting rights? Because I couldn't envisage why that would be a problem or different or whatever.
We found out something interesting when we were there. I think at most England and Wales fans, and probably fans from around the world, will expect to go to Qatar. If they've got an apartment, if they've got a hotel room, they flick the TV on and they will be able to watch the football, watch the games. That's going to be one of the only things to do in Qatar, let's face it. What we found out is that the beIN, who obviously own the sports right there, Qatari-owned company, are basically charging a premium for the hotels and bars. So the hoteliers we spoke to have told us that they are being asked to pay significant sums for each location that they want to show the football in. And by each location, if they're a hotel that's got 10 bars and restaurants, some of them have, they've got to pay a charge for each of those. So the hoteliers we spoke to said that a lot of our smaller places, the smaller cafes, it's just not worth us paying the fee. So we're restricting where we're showing it. Worse still, they're saying that they're not even going to show it in their hotel rooms because the fee to pay to do that is astronomical. So one hotel we spoke to that's got one of the teams staying in it actually said that the players aren't going to be able to watch the World Cup games in their rooms. That's, you know, that's something for travelling fans to bear in mind. I mean, there are ways, of course, I wouldn't like to suggest it, but I believe there are ways in which you can connect to back home, perhaps through a PC, and watch the game as if you were in England. And I think that's probably advisable for anyone going out there to take a PC and an HDMI cable and see what they can do. Because, sadly, it looks like being able to watch the football everywhere you go around the country is not going to happen. We did push back on this. We explained to them that this is such a significant part of a tournament for everybody, and we urge them to relook at it, but I can't see it changing. Right.
Talk to us about antisocial behaviour. Obviously, you know, football fans, obviously unlikely to be wasted, but, you know, very, very rich football fans who've drunk 10 pints of beer for 150 quid. They might, you know, have a fight. Bad idea anywhere, not a good idea in Qatar, right?
Yeah, I think there's two sides to this. We're told that the Qatari police, the extra security forces, have all been taught about the sort of behaviour to expect and told to be lenient. But on the other side, you know, the travelling fans are going to have to respect the difference in culture here. And there's bound to be some clashes. We had some bizarre discussions with the security guys around certain scenarios. The one that stands out is we asked, you know, what happens if an England fan in the stadium, middle of the day game, it's hot, takes his top off, waves it around his head or whatever he might do, or just stands there with his top off. Certain England fans do that all the time, whatever the weather. The stack response there is they will be thrown out of the stadium. And we said, well, you know, guys, you realize this will create a situation that doesn't exist. You know, if you do that, people around that area will question why this person's being ejected, because they wouldn't have seen them do anything wrong. And the flat response was, no, they will be ejected. Now, I think part of that is them just quoting rules and regulations in front of us. I can't see it happening, but we are going to have to be careful. We may have to change the way we act a little bit. The way people would normally act on a tournament might be frowned upon. And I think the key thing is, if anyone from the police or security services out there asks you to do something, just do it. Don't become confrontational. I think if you become confrontational, that's when things will escalate. That's when you might find yourself chucked in the back of a police van, and you want to try and avoid that in Qatar.
Can we talk about LGBTQ plus supporters? Obviously, we will do podcasts about the experiences of Qataris from the LGBTQ plus community and what their life is like for fans who might be going. I mean, from what you're saying, I'd be amazed if anybody go. I'm amazed you're going. I'm amazed anybody's going. But like specifically, I'd be very surprised if any gay fans went. But what is the situation going to be like, do you think, if they did?
I think it will be fine. The disappointing thing is that the state and FIFA have just repeated the standard line is that everyone's welcome. They haven't addressed specifically that LGBT plus fans are also welcome. If we speak to people living there, they will tell us that, look, in reality, there's actually a sort of thriving gay scene in Doha. It's tucked away. And as long as effectively it's out of the way, it's allowed to continue. So it's not like people are sort of being banged on their doors and being dragged out into the streets, you know, if they are an LGBT plus person. But nevertheless, it's disappointing that we can't get a more firm commitment from either FIFA or the Supreme Committee that LGBT plus fans are welcome. I don't think there's many of the LGBT plus regular England travellers that are going. I know one or two have been considering it, but because of what they hear about the country, because they can't get reassured about their own safety, or in fact that they're going to be made to feel welcome, they're not going, and that's of course disappointing. I think that going forward, you know, FIFA really ought to look at where they award World Cups, and part of it should be based on welcoming absolutely everybody and a firm commitment to make that clear.
The stadiums we haven't touched on yet, are they? Do they look all done and finished? Obviously, as again, we will do pods about how they've been built and the people that have suffered to build them. It almost feels trite to say, like, are they ready? But are they?
Stadiums are ready. Some of the surrounding perimeters still look a bit like a wasteland. But by the time the World Cup comes, they'll be full up with, you know, the FIFA sponsors, and they'll all be all the colours that you'd expect of all the FIFA sponsors. I'm sure they'll be fine. Travel to most of the stadiums is okay. Some of the stadiums, you have quite a long walk once you get there. If you get the metro to some of them, you have to get off a metro, then get a bus. And even when you get off the bus, you may still have a mile or so walk to the stadium. So that it's another thing that we've raised with them. Not everybody that travels around and watches football around the world is completely mobile. And it's not just about whether you're in a wheelchair or not. There's plenty of people that are ambulance disabled, and there's certainly not enough facilities to deal with that. There's no spaces for people to rest. I mean, when we went to the game a couple of weeks ago, it was about 35 degrees. It's not going to be that hot in November or December, but it's still maybe 25, 27, 28. And when you're asked to walk a few miles to and from a stadium in that heat, with nowhere to rest, nowhere to get water, some people will suffer. And we've made that very clear to the Supreme Committee that they need to try and think about that.
Just as a fan, is there any part of you thinks, I might just skip this one?
It's not going to be the greatest, but I think, you know, when we all went to Russia 4 years ago, despite what's happening with Russia at the moment, everyone thought that was going to be a dreadful World Cup. It turned out to be a fantastic experience. So I think there'll be some real positive moments. I'm sure the newspapers and TV cameras around the world will capture some amazing pictures of like huge groups of 16 different nations of fans all gathered together into a great big picture. I'm sure there'll be some great experiences like that. But it's not, in a way, it's, I suppose it's going to be hard work to make some of that fun. Whereas normally everything becomes a lot more easier, a lot more natural when you're going to a country just for a tournament such as this.
And have you got any idea how many England fans are planning to go?
We think, like, so classic England fans that are members of the England Travel Club, coming from England or Great Britain, somewhere in the region of 2,000 to 3,000 in the early stages. If England were to progress to the final, that will jump probably to 8,000 or more. But the thing, the big unknown that we've been trying to get information on is the expat community. So in Qatar alone, there is 22,000 British expats. And in the greater region, the GCC region, the Foreign Office tells us there's over 100,000. A lot of those lads will be on, lads and lasses, sorry, a lot of those will be on probably quite reasonable, potentially low tax salaries. And a trip to Qatar from Dubai will be quite simple for them. They might not be a typical England fan. They might have never even seen an England game, home or away, but we expect to see the stadiums quite full for those sort of people.
And actually, I mean, Wales fans, you could imagine it's for England fans who've been to lots of World Cups, they can say, I can miss one. But Wales fans, despite all the, you know, ethical dilemmas, etc., you know, this is their chance, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we're expecting a similar number of Welsh fans. You know, we work closely with our guys that run the Welsh Fan Embassy. They think similar numbers. They know a lot, as we do for England fans, a lot are going to stay in Dubai and try either drive across the Saudi, across Saudi Arabia to the border, or get the cheap flights in and out. And again, these are things that we've discussed with the Supreme Committee and with the consulate out there. They're all very aware of that. The Saudi border will be open. You won't be able to take your car from Saudi Arabia into Qatar. You have to park it on the border and there'll be a bus service to run you in. But those things are possible and people are planning them to save money.
Brilliant. Ashley Brown, thank you so much. Worth mentioning as well that the nominations are open for the Football Supporters Association Awards. If there's any podcasts or radio shows you would like to nominate, you're very welcome to. Cheers, Ashley. Take it easy. We don't have a lot of time, chaps, but God, that sounds absolutely terrible, John.
Listen, before every World Cup, there are scare stories about how bad things are going to be. I mean, you know, I went to South Africa, I went to Brazil, both were fine. But actually, the thing about this World Cup is it just sounds like it's going to be, apart from the football, so bloody boring.
Yeah. And you can't even watch the other games. I mean, that's insane.
Well, that bit, yeah. I mean, when we sent a checklist of that, that was flagged up, and I didn't know it was going to be that bad. But then when I thought about it, I thought, okay, yeah. Yeah, so you can't even watch the football. Listen, you know, you don't have to go and drink there. Of course you don't. But that's what England fans do. And to go to that tournament, it's going to cost a lot of people a lot of money from what was described there. It still feels beyond the obvious questions of human rights and how the bid was won that this is a wholly unsuitable venue to hold a World Cup, which after all, and if you've been to these events, you'll know, is that brings together nations to watch football together. And this appears to be completely inhospitable in a different way to other countries and a deeply boring one. Not for me. I'm glad I'll be in Macclesfield and East London.
Yeah. Can we move on, Lars? Erling Haaland's been asked about sports washing,
yes.
Which is quite interesting, given his move to Manchester City. What's he said?
Well, he's been put in a slightly awkward position. Well, or I suppose Norwegians have been put in an awkward position because there's been a very strong anti-Qatar World Cup sentiment in our country, and now suddenly our shining light is playing for an Abu Dhabi-owned club, which is a little bit awkward, I suppose. And the question he was asked in a presser now after joining up with the international squad was, this is the question, the owners at Manchester City are accused of massive human rights violations and for imprisoning their own citizens. You're now playing for Manchester City. What do you think about the owners of the club you represent? And he answers, I've never met them, so I don't know them like that. Which is quite a thing. And followed up by saying, these are very strong allegations you're making. When you put it like that, the only thing I can really do is not say anything about it. I think the words you're using are a bit strong, was his reply, which I think is I suppose it's better than not interacting with the question at all. He could have gone the sort of the Eddie Howe route and said, I'm just a football man. I don't think it's an answer that'll convince a lot of people who are already skeptical of this arrangement. And, you know, he goes on to point out that I've been a City fan my whole life and talked about how I've made my decision with because of the coach and because of how he thinks he'll develop in a sporting sense, which I'm sure is true. But it is a slightly weird situation to be in. I think the national team coach, Ståle Solbakken, answered perhaps a little bit more eloquently when he was asked about the subject and said that what I think is that it's very difficult to put that kind of responsibility on an individual. And he said that City have been approved by the Premier League, so where the line should be drawn with all that stuff is very difficult to say. It's much bigger than just the individual. It's a much bigger political question than something the individual has to be responsible for, was the line from the national team coach, which I suppose seems a little bit more reasonable. But I don't know them like that. It's probably not the best reply, I would say.
Naz says a couple of things. Hi Max, I'd really appreciate if you can give a shout out to the Bangladeshi women's team for winning the SAFF Women's Championships. We beat the host Nepal in the final 3-1 in front of a sold out crowd of 15,700 people. The biggest step for women's sports in Bangladesh ever. Congratulations to you. And slightly different, Tommy sent a tweet saying it's all fun at Dundee United this Christmas. I don't know if this is a real tweet from Dundee United. I very much hope it is. But they're advertising their Christmas party. And it says, Christmas at Tannadice. Get into the festive spirit with the return of our Christmas party nights across December, priced at just £45 per person. Top. Glass of jizz. It's a wonder. It's an absolutely tremendous typo, isn't it? You get a glass of jizz. Three-course Christmas dinner, entertainment, and a live DJ. And also, the emoji they've used for glass of jizz is champagne. Three-course dinner is a plate. Entertainment is the dancing emoji. And next to live DJ is a woman in a wheelchair, which makes absolutely no sense at all. Don't miss out. Hashtag United in Pursuit. So very much hope that hope it's real, because it's funny.
Well, that'll be £450 in Doha, so I don't know what anyone's complaining about, really.
15 quid a pint, isn't it?
15 quid a pint.
Honestly,
that's how much it is.
The way the whole setup in Doha is described, it sounds like a very elaborate scheme to promote abstinence from alcohol consumption. It's like it just put people into a very sort of hot world where you have to go to a sort of a dystopian rave with a giant spider to have a drink, and the only thing that's available is like Budweiser or Bud Zero.
The only time you can drink is to have a Eurobop at 10 in the morning.
For give 75 quid.
Wow, God. That'll do for today. Thank you so much, Nick. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Cheers, John.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back on Monday. Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove with Uzi Majid. Our executive producer is Christian Bent.
This is The Guardian.